This is the 2011 Rocky Mountain Bible School. This is day four, class two. Our speaker is Brother Mark Vincent, and he's speaking to the general topic of the enigma of Ecclesiastes. And today we have him speaking to the subject of a lesson in economics. Brother Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. So this isn't going to be a lesson in economics, after all. the ominous presence of brother Ron and others in the audience, I dare not. Now, actually, this would have been a really good talk, this one, but you picked the wrong one. That's the trouble with democracy, isn't it? People make bad choices. Let me just tell you what we would have talked about. You know, this is just an interesting thing for you might want to follow this up in your own time if you have any. Just this idea of the vocabulary of economics and finance in the book of Ecclesiastes is really interesting. So we've talked quite a bit already, haven't we, about the notion of profit, about what's left over. But there's a whole set of other words as well that come from that same sort of family. Money, the preacher talks about, wages, inheritance, riches, success and accomplishments. He talks about accounts, of searching out and finding out the account of things. And we talked about the ledgers of life, didn't we? And the assets and the liabilities and what's left over. Well, nothing is left over. There is no profit. Once the revenue has come in and the costs have been paid, there's nothing left over. The preacher talks about consuming and consumers. He talks about deficits, about what is lacking. He talks about abundance and wealth, about venture and business, about portion, people's portion, their allotment. And all that, it's all related to the same basic semantic feel, isn't it? The same word family of finance and economics. And it's a fascinating theme to trace through. And as I say, you might want to look at that in your own time. What we're going to do instead today is to talk about time. That's what you wanted. So that'll be sort of the first half, and then we're going to go on to talk about a little bit more about the contradictions that we began by considering yesterday and the inscrutability of this life. And that should take us our time, I think. So let's start then by thinking about time. Now, I've not measured this myself, but it's apparently the case that during the course of a lifetime, a man will shave off 22 feet of facial hair, which is quite a lot of hair, isn't it? And it's quite unpleasant, really, thinking about it. And it's interesting that in the French language, the way that you say something is boring is that you say it's shaving, or that it's the beard, literally, because, you know, who wants to shave? Who wants to sit there in front of the mirror doing that? And you say, I didn't want to do it so much that I actually abandoned it, and several of the other brothers here have done so too and have bought themselves beard trimmers, and that's much more economical use of time, but it means you end up looking like this, so there's always a downside. But that's just one example. Shaving is just one example of the activities that our lives are full of, isn't it? Like cutting our toenails. You know, there's not a lot of satisfaction that we get from it, as far as I can tell. But we just have to do it. And washing the clothes and doing the washing up, and, you know, various of the activities that we have to do at work, like sitting in meetings, you know, what we would give if we never had to sit in another meeting at work. And yet, all this stuff is dictated to us by life, isn't it? And we imagine ourselves to have this freedom, you know, here I am, able to make my choices, but in fact I'm continually hedged in by all these things that life puts in front of me and makes me do. And you know, I suppose I could choose not to cut my toenails, but ultimately it all becomes a bit of a mess, doesn't it, if we do that. And you know, we could choose not to wash, but there's a downside to that. And in the end of the day, we say, well, I'm just going to have to bite the bullet. I'm just going to have to do it. Now, when we come to the time poem in Ecclesiastes 3, you say, well, what's the point of this poem? Why would this be in the Bible? You know, in what sense does he mean it when he says, to everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven? And it's true, you know, on a very mundane, trivial level, it's true, isn't it? There's a time that I was born, and there's a time that I'll die, and there's a time when I trim my beard, and a time when I cut my toenails. And that's true, but it's not very interesting, is it? No one else, you know, I mean, people might care about my death or my birth a little, hopefully, but they don't really care about me cutting my toenails, fortunately. And I don't care about it too. I mean, I just wish it didn't happen. So the poem must be saying more than that, mustn't it? It must be saying more than, you know, there is a time when I do various things in life. Yeah, sure there is, but so what? So is it getting more at the way in which our lives are dictated and controlled by these events, and we can't escape from them? We're fenced in, just like we're hemmed in by death and fenced in by it, and there's no way we can go beyond it in the terms of this life. It's the ultimate leveler, the ultimate finisher of us. So too, the times of our lives hem us in and dictate to us and forbid us the very freedom that we are so fond of and think that we have and take such pride in. So there was nothing that I could do about the time of my birth, and you know, generally, obviously there are ways that a human can end its own life, but generally speaking, there's not a lot I can do about the time of my death. But that's the case for many of these other things as well. There is a time for war. And, you know, I may not want to go to war, but if the king, living in ancient Israel now, you know, if God says we must drive out the Canaanites, then it is the time for war. And if the Philistines invade, then it is the time for war. And like it or not, that's what I have to do. And if I have a hole in my shirt, then it is time to sew it up. And there is a time to sew in that sense. And I can choose not to, of course. I can say, well, I'm not going to. I have free will, and I'm going to choose not to sew my shirt. Well, of course, what will happen then is the tear will get worse, and I will have missed sewing's time, and it'll be too late, won't it? It'll be too late to sew up my shirt, because the hole will be too big, and the shirt will be beyond repair, and I will have paid the price of missing the time. And do you notice that time, the time to sew, doesn't belong to me, does it? It belongs to sowing. It's sowing's time. It's the circumstances of my life that dictate into me that this is the time to sow. And I can choose to take it, or I can choose to leave it and throw the shirt away, but ultimately, that is sowing's time. And that's the case for a lot of these things. You have to do them when you have to do them, and a time to mourn. And we'd probably all choose not to have that time, but that time is imposed upon us, and we're controlled by it. Now, do you notice that each of these things in this poem, they're all arranged in pairs, aren't they? There's a time to be born, and you think that's good. The creation of life, that's a nice positive. But there's an equal and opposite negative, isn't there? There's a time to die, and that takes it all away. And so there's no profit under the sun, because nothing's left at the end. And there's a time for peace, And that seems like a good thing. We like peace, and we can bask in that peace for a few years or months maybe. But we know that another war is coming. And there's a time for war that undermines the time for peace. And so at the end of the day, the two things cancel each other out and there is no profit. And there's a time to sow. And there's a time to reap. And then we're back to where we started again, aren't we? And there's no profit. And so that's why, or that's one of the reasons why, the poem concludes as it does in this most jarring way. So we talked about these jarring juxtapositions in Ecclesiastes, didn't we? And we've got exactly the same thing. We have a time for this and a time for that. Verse 8, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboureth? And we're back to the point that where we began, aren't we, in Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 3. What profit hath a man of all the labour that he taketh under the sun? We're back to zero again. We're back with a blank slate. So that's part of the aspect. We've considered now two of the aspects then of this time poem. So one of them is that, you know, we think we're in control, and yet all these things are happening around us to conspire to take the control away from us. Because all these events, the sowing and the war and the death and the peace, that's all dictating to me how I should behave. And I can kick against the pricks and say, well, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to sow. But then there's going to be a price to pay for that that is worse than if I just followed the time. And then I could choose not to go to war, I suppose, but then I'd be at risk for being a deserter, wouldn't I? Because it was my duty to go to war in ancient Israel. So that's one aspect, then, this way that these times hedge us in. And then another aspect of it is this fact that everything balances out and the net result is zero. There's no profit under the sun. So it's all very well, and this may be another example where Solomon is quoting sort of traditional wisdom. You know, like people say, a good name is better than precious ointment. And they say, yeah, that's nice, it is. And then Solomon comes back with, yeah, and it's better to die than to be born. And sort of undermines the whole thing. Is it something similar here? And you can't prove it one way or the other, but it could be that there was this notion of, you know, an appropriate time, a fitting time for things. And Solomon is saying, well, yes, and sort of expanding on the idea, there's time for all this, but all these things come in pairs. And it may well be true that there's a time for all these things, but when they've all been done, there's no net profit at the end of it all. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboureth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. And here, with this idea of beautiful, he's getting at the idea of something that's fitting. You know, when there's a hole in my shirt, it's fitting that I should sew it up. When somebody dies that I care about, it's fitting that there should be a time of mourning. You know, the fancy word is apposite, isn't it? It's fitting. It's apposite that should be the case. So there are all these times, and we can look at all these different times in our life, and yet we have this sense that, which we've mentioned, haven't we? I think I've probably mentioned it in every talk so far. There is this sense that there should be something more, shouldn't there? Can't we get beyond these times? Should it be the case that I'm hemmed in like this by all these things? Isn't there a freedom above these times? Isn't there something else in life? And there is there not, in every human being, in some sense, this longing for transcendence, this longing for something more, something which goes beyond, this longing for eternity. You know, we were talking yesterday about the image of God and the fate of beasts. This sense that we have that there ought to be more to life than this. And it's in that context, I think, that the next thing that Solomon says here is fascinating. He hath made everything beautiful or fitting in its time. Also, he has set the world in their hearts. He has set eternity in their hearts. So, human beings have this sense of the eternal, then. This sense of something more, something that goes beyond. And we long for it, and yet we can't ever get there, can we? And the only way we can get there is by God inviting us to participate in it and to come to know life eternal. Now, that's of course another story. That's not the story of Ecclesiastes. The story of Ecclesiastes is this sense that we have that there must be something that transcends these times. There must be the eternal out there somewhere, and everybody wants it, and they can't access it except through the offer of salvation that God brings. Now, even Nietzsche, you know, we don't have a lot in common with Nietzsche, really, do we? But even he appreciated this, and he talked about the difference between a human being and a cow. And he talked about how a cow is perfectly happy in the moment, you know, just stood there chewing the cud. And a cow has no sense, as far as we know, of its past. And it has no sense of its future. A cow has no concept of its legacy, does it? It's just a cow stood there chewing and the food going through its seven stomachs. And he's perfectly happy just being there, being a cow. And sometimes, don't you think, you know, if only we could be perfectly happy just being there, just chewing. And if that was all there was to do in life and all there was to worry about, sometimes that feels like that would be really nice, doesn't it? And yet, we're not like that. And Nietzsche recognized that. You know, we do have this sense of the past, and that brings us regret. And it brings us a sense of missed opportunity, and it brings us some good things too. And we have this sense of the future, and we're always thinking and planning for the future and longing that the future is going to be better than this moment that we're now in. And this longing for eternity that the cow does not have. And that's what makes us different from the beasts, isn't it? And God has built that into us. God has put eternity into our hearts. But nobody can find out how to get there unless God invites them to do so, which is what the rest of the Bible is about. Now, I'd like to come on to something else as well that arises from this time poem. So it's all very well to talk about there being a right and a fitting time for various things. Now, so sowing is an easy one, isn't it? A time to sow. But what about marriage? Time to marry. Now, it may be that there is a fitting time for that for us, but nobody tells us when it is, do they? And when we meet the girl or the boy, we don't know. Nobody passes us a piece of paper which says, and this now is the one for you. This is the time. We might get the time wrong. We might think it's the time for something. We might think it's the time to take this particular job. But we don't know that it is, do we? And of course, we pray about it and we seek God's guidance and we interpret things that happen in our life as being the hand of God at work in our lives, and we believe that the hand of God is at work in our lives. But we don't receive, you know, a written, inspired message that tells us with 100% certainty that that is the case. You know, some of it is down to our interpretation on the basis of faith, isn't it? So, for example, you know, there are people in the world who have no belief in God who almost have incredibly bad things happen to them and they escape. And there are things, and there are cases like that in the truth. And you can't prove that in our case it was because the hand of God was at work, and in their case it was just random. That's a view of faith in our case, isn't it? If some disaster is averted in our lives, then we don't have the proof that that was the specific intervention of God at that time. But some of that is a position of faith, and we believe. And of course, we have scriptural verses to tell us, and so that's the proof, in a sense, that God is in control and that his hand is at work. But, and so we have to proceed in faith, but it is in faith rather than in certain knowledge, isn't it? And so that raises the possibility then that it may be the time for something, but that we get the time wrong, that we mistake it. So it could be sowing's time and I refuse to sow, or I could think it's sowing's time and start sowing and actually it isn't, it's the time for something else. So the problem then is that God knows the times, he is the master of time, the lord of time, and we don't, and we're kind of bumbling through, shuffling through, trying to find our way to some extent in the dark. And this is picked up much more explicitly in chapter 8 and verse 6. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment. So that sounds like chapter 3, doesn't it? That sounds like just like what we've been considering. Therefore, the misery of man is great upon him. Now, how does that fit together? To everything there is a time, to every purpose there is time and judgment. Great, that sounds positive and concrete. That sounds like a foundation to build upon. Therefore, the misery of man is great upon him. Why would we be miserable about that? Well, he explains why in verse 7. For he knoweth not that which shall be, and who can tell him when it shall be? So the problem is, there may well be a time, but we don't know what time it is. That's the irony, isn't it? God has the clock and we don't. And we're proceeding in a sort of partially informed ignorance. And this again is another reminder of who we are, isn't it? This is another reminder of our status in his sight, of our relative position, and of why we need him, and why we must lay our lives out before him and say, Lord, show me what time it is and what I should do, and guide me and direct me in my life, because I'm hopeless without it. So these observations of the preacher lead us to faith, don't they? They lead us to trust more in God. And in that sense, then, they're thoroughly positive. Now, there's more on time in chapter 3 that we could dig through. But in the interest of some of the places I'd like us to go to, let's carry on in chapter 9, because you know, it'd be good to talk a little bit about the time and chance verse, wouldn't it? Because that's a little bit of a crux verse. It's a sort of famous verse that people sort of discuss and wonder about. So what is it saying? Let's go to chapter 9 and verse 11. I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. But time and chance happeneth to them all. So what does it mean? Is this the doctrine of randomness in the scriptures, for example? Well, you know, usually what we do, we talk about time and chance, don't we, without looking at what came earlier in the verse. And then so there's a red light goes on there, then isn't this right away? Because we say, well, we've got to understand the context in which this time and chance phrase occurs. So that's one point. We're going to need to look at the context. Then the other point is the word chance. So the word chance then in English conjures up the ideas of probability and randomness, doesn't it? Which I think takes us in the wrong direction. You know, that makes us think, as readers in English, that makes us think of the idea of a dice being tossed and, you know, of all that. But that's not really the idea that is there in the Hebrew word. So the idea, the word for chance there is basically a thing that happens. Now, it's not expressed for what reason it happens. It's not expressed whether it happens because I do something stupid or wise, whether it's because someone else does something stupid or wise, or whether it's because God does something or wise. The focus of this is not on what the cause of the thing happening is. Do you see the point there? The point of the verse is, the focus of the verse is just on things happen, right? Now, as it turns out, these are usually bad things. And that's relevant in this context. So the verb that this noun chance comes from is the verb to meet. So, you know, so things meet you in life. You know, I go out there and I start driving down the street and the car crashes into me. You know, I've met a car crash. If you know what I mean, I've met another car in a very physical sense in that example, haven't I? But you know, I could be walking out there and I meet a brother or a sister, and we've met. It's happened that the two of us have come together. It's happened in that particular case because I decided to go for a walk, and so I met Sister Susie the other day, and she happened to have gone for a run, and she was coming back, and I was going out with the baby, and we met each other, and that meeting happened. And we both had reasons for being out there that were the reason why we met. But the fact is, you know, the interesting thing, and it's not that interesting, but the interesting thing is that we met, not the particular reasons why we did. You know? Now, but often in the scriptures, when this idea of meeting, it's sort of a bad meeting. So it's like the meeting of the car crash. So I went out, or someone went out, and a lion met him. You know, the chances are the lion didn't meet him to be stroked. Or robbers met him. The robbers didn't meet him to shake hands and say, hi, how are you doing? You're having a nice day. And similarly here, the time and the happening, the meeting, is, you know, the context tells you, and the usual use of the word tells you. It's something that we would perceive of as being a bad thing that happens and meets us. Now, another thing that's worth noting, a bit technical, but it's worth noting, that time and chance, you see there's two words there, so you would expect a plural verb, wouldn't you? I can't think of a plural verb now, but you would expect one. But it's actually a single verb, a singular verb. Which means that time and chance, or time and happening, is effectively one idea. So we should probably cash it out as something like a time of misfortune or a mishap. But mishaps happen. Yeah? And of course the word mishap has happen in it, doesn't it? Hap in it. So there are mishaps. And now again, the mishap might be me, because I do something stupid. It might be because someone else does something stupid, you know, because someone drives their car on the wrong side of the road when I go out there and they crash into me. Or it could be because God specifically intervenes to change what might otherwise have happened to make something that I perceive as a mishap happen to me. But the cause of the mishap isn't the point at issue. The fact is that there is, from my perspective, a mishap. All right. So let's think then about the context of this verse. I returned and I saw under the sun, 9:11, that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. So he looks at five different categories there, and what he's saying in effect is, no matter what position you're in, there are no guarantees. Okay? So suppose you're really fast. that would lead you to assume that you're going to win the race. But it ain't necessarily so. Because you could do something to your Achilles tendon just before the race was about to begin. Suppose you're really strong. You would think that that means you're going to win the battle. You're going to be okay, because if ever there's a battle, you're the strong one and you're going to win it. But the opponent might have a smarter strategy than you, and your strength might not count for anything. So there are no guarantees, are there, just because you're strong, of anything. On the law of averages, you ought to do better because you're stronger, but you have no basis for certainty or confidence in that at all. Because things happen in life. There are mishaps of all kinds. There are happenings of all kinds for all kinds of reasons and causes that prevent what you would logically assume to be the consequence from actually being the consequence, and something else happens instead. There are no guarantees. And we could proceed like this for each of the five examples. Neither yet bread to the wise. So just because you're wise, there are some wise people who are not successful and don't necessarily have a lot of bread to eat. Nor yet riches to men of understanding. Just because you have understanding doesn't mean you're going to be rich. So you see, each of these five examples are saying, no matter what you assume is going to be the case, actually, you can't assume it. Because stuff happens in life that contradicts what you would have expected to be the case. Times of mishap, of misfortune, you get met by something that you didn't expect, and things don't work out that way. Now, how many people have found in their lives that things haven't worked out as they'd expected? Now, you know, the question's the other way around, isn't it? Who is there in the room who hasn't found that to be the case, you know? We all have found that to be the case, and we've probably found it to be the case many times, haven't we? Life constantly confounds our expectations. There are no guarantees. There are no certain rules. And this is another of the vanities of our existence in this life, so that I cannot trust in my own strength, my own speed, my own riches, my own health, my own nationality. There is no basis for confidence or for boasting in any of those things, because no matter what it is, and no matter how certain it seems to be, that the time of mishap can strike like that, and I'm brought to nothing. And this too is another leveler, isn't it? Where all human beings are exposed to these risks, and we cannot break out of them. All we can do is trust in God. This is another respect in which we come to know our place in God's sight. Now, that continues then. He continues in verse 12 to expand on this, and then I think that he's talking, let's read it. For man also knoweth not his time. And we talked about that, didn't we? About we don't know what time it is. As the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in a snare, so also are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them. And, you know, that might be talking about how death could suddenly fall upon someone when they weren't expecting it, but it could just be talking about how these mishaps, these things of misfortune, bad things that we don't expect, suddenly happen. So that's what I wanted to say about time, and within all that discussion, we've again been talking about contradictions, haven't we? You know, how it ought to be the case that because a person is rich or wise or fast, that we could assume thus and so, but there's always the counterexample that stops us from assuming it. And we saw that yesterday too in the examples that we looked at there. So that brings us again then into this topic of contradictions. And I just want to, let's just take another couple of examples. Two examples, one from chapter 2. 13. Then I saw that wisdom excelled folly as far as light excelleth darkness. So here's a great positive, and this again could be a traditional wisdom saying, couldn't it? This could be something from Proverbs. Wisdom exceeds folly as far as light exceeds darkness. And he believes it too. The preacher believes this too. He sees that this is the case. But there's a but. There's always a but in this life. Before we get to the but, he says a bit more in verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. So better to have eyes in your head, isn't it? Better to see where you're going. That's good. The fool walks in darkness. But, and I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. So there's the thing that undermines the observation. There's the thing that reduces its impact as far as this life as an end in itself is concerned, as far as this order of the human condition that we now live in is concerned. Death comes along to contradict the observation. And as the wise dieth, so dieth the fool. So pretty simple example there. And you know, what's suggested there by some scholars is that some of what he does here is he quotes traditional sayings. He quotes them to agree with them and then to show that, but there's also another aspect to it too. So here the traditional saying might be, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. Now, of course, you can't prove whether he is quoting or not, and ultimately it doesn't matter very much. But I think it's quite an interesting idea that he may be doing so. It's a bit like in Corinthians, you know, in Corinthians where Paul says all things are lawful, and I'm sure you're familiar with the idea that all things are lawful there is a quotation of what the Corinthians were saying. You know, they had this little saying, this little watchword, all things are lawful, and therefore I can be sexually promiscuous if I feel like it. And Paul says, well, all things are lawful, well, maybe so in one sense, but all things are not expedient, all things edify not. So he comes back with a rejoinder, doesn't he, that sets the one thing, which is true in a certain sense, you know, we've been redeemed from the things of the law, into context. And you need both truths to get a complete picture, don't you? You know, if you run with all things are lawful, if that's your whole maxim for life, then you end up with debauchery, don't you, and excess. So that's not enough to say all things are lawful. You have to say all things, you have to also know that all things are not expedient. And similarly, the preacher's technique is to set one thing against the other. And so the preacher, when we have these so-called contradictions, the preacher isn't contradicting himself as so much as he's observing contradictions in life. And he's saying that you have to look at both of these aspects to get a full picture of how life really is. And that in some respects, truth can only be expressed to us in the limits of human language in things that are seemingly contradictory or that are contradictory. So, you know, we might think about predestination and free will, mightn't we? And, you know, we're not going to get into that whole thing, but, you know, we need a lot more time, wouldn't we, for that? But you know, both of those concepts are taught in the scriptures to a certain extent. And there's a risk when we've got those two concepts of predestination and free will that we exalt one over the other to try and rationalize them. We say, well, predestination doesn't really mean that. Really, it's foreknowledge. And we might, for example, this is a possible reconciliation strategy, we might try and make predestination mean the same thing as foreknowledge. But there's a word for foreknowledge and there's a word for predestination. You know, these are two different concepts. They're not the same thing. The New Testament could have chosen to use the word foreknowledge all the time, but it doesn't. And we're not able to completely reconcile these concepts, are we? Well, you might be, but I'm not, and I've not yet read anyone who I think satisfactorily, you know, completely satisfactorily does reconcile them. And so you're left with this tension of saying, well, I have to have both of these factors in view and have a sense of them both and be aware of the reality of both in trying to understand how to proceed in life. And that's difficult, isn't it? Because it's human nature to want to to want to rationalize and have everything in neat compartments and have everything worked out. Ecclesiastes is all about the absurdities of life, the incongruities, the things that don't fit, the fact that there are so many things in life that stop us having this perfect model, this map for life. You know, to say, I've got it sussed now, I've got it cracked, and I know how it's all going to work out. And God forbids us from ever being at that place, so that we remember in this life who we are, and so that we can prepare ourselves for what by His grace we can become. So, let's just take one other example in chapter 9. Well, let's not do that because we don't have time. But if you've got some time, again, just have a look. Just have to look at chapter 9 and verse 11. Verse 13 through to the end of the chapter. So just five little verses there. And just look at, he gives a little example of a city and a poor man. And just notice in that passage how it's a constant series of positives and negatives. He says a good thing, and then he says, ah, but there's something else to consider that undermines the good. And then he says, ah, but there's another good aspect. And then there's a negative aspect of that good one, and positive, and then a negative. And he goes like that all the way through the passage, and it's very interesting. Who's seen Fiddler on the Roof? Now, you know the scenes where Topol says, where he's working out whether he should give his daughter to that particular husband, and it's that but on the other hand moment, isn't it? And that's exactly how it is with the preacher. For everything that he sees, there is a but on the other hand. And this is absolutely a deliberate part of the book. And it's absolutely, and this is what we'll get into tomorrow, this is absolutely something that God has designed into nature, into the human experience. Now, I'd like to finish then with two other passages that talk about our inability to rationalize everything, to reconcile all these contradictory things, these things in tension. These are important passages. Chapter 7 and verse 13. Consider the work of God. For who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Now, do you see the implications of what it's saying there? That's a massive verse, isn't it? Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Do you see what he's asserting there? He's asserting that these contradictions, these vanities, these things that don't fit are there because God wants them to be there in this life. God wants to hedge us in that way as a route for us to find him. That our own logic can't bring us there, and only God's logic can. He has made this world crooked in some of the ways that we've been considering, and there are a whole load of other ways in Ecclesiastes that we've not had time to get to. He's made crooked. He's warped it. You know, that's what the word means. God has put these warps, these kinks into the world, which is, it's a remarkable notion, isn't it? And the next verse goes on. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. There's the positive and the negative. The two set each other off, don't they? They counterbalance each other. God also hath set the one over against the other to the end that man should find nothing after him. So that man can't find his own way. Because there's always the possibility of a warp. Just when you think you've got the rule, I've got the key to life and how I should live it. For every self-help book, there is a warp that stops us ultimately helping ourselves and makes it so that only God can help us. The other passage, well, actually, there's two more passages, chapter 8 and verse 16. This is one of my favorite passages in the book. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes. So the preacher here, he'd totally given himself. You know, he put more resources and effort into this than any of us ever will. You know, into trying to straighten out like the things in life and trying to observe it and analyze it and categorize it all as humans so love to do, and finding that, you know, you create all these little boxes and you try and put things in the boxes, but the drawers won't shut and you're banging them, you're trying to get them shut and saying, fit into my category, please. Just make, you know, let me impose order on you, world. And the world is saying, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to fit in that box. God's plan is bigger than our little boxes. So even though he didn't give sleep or slumber to his eyes, that was how intensely he worked on this problem, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. So ultimately, his whole experiment was a complete failure, wasn't it? In one sense. And yet, the very failure was the success and the solution. That the only thing to do in life then is to fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole man. And that's all that it can be about for us. And no philosophy or psychology or theory of any other kind is going to bring all the answers. So look again at what he says. I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. So there's the first assertion. A man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. So that's now the second assertion, isn't it? Though, no matter how hard you work, even if you don't allow yourself to sleep, as Solomon didn't, you won't be able to find it. Now, did you get that? Solomon's saying. I've said it twice now, but have you really got it? Because there's always going to be some guy who's at the back of the class, you know, like the student who is like, but I've got the answer. If you look at it like this, then you can make sense of it all. But Solomon silences that guy. Yea, Father, though a wise man think to know it, if anyone should be presumptuous enough to think that they have all the answers, yet shall he not be able to find it. That's a pretty definitive conclusion there, isn't it? Said three times by Solomon in that verse. So to anyone who thinks he's got all the answers, got it all figured out, you know, how this life and this world works, then that's the preacher's response to that person. And that this is the work of God. The final passage we'll conclude with is chapter 11 and verse 5. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb in the womb of her that is with child, even so, thou knowest not the works of God who worketh, who maketh all. So he talks about the spiritual and the natural, doesn't he? Talks about the ways of the Spirit, how God is working on a spiritual level through the power of his Spirit, how God is working to save people in the world. And we don't have all the answers to that. And he talks about the natural, how the bones are knit together in the womb of her that is with child. And what, you know, what more amazing miracle could there be than the gift of conception and childbirth from God's hand? Even so, thou knowest not the works of God who waketh all. So how should we live then, if that's the case? Well, that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow.